So good evening. This week we have the two parshas of Tazria and Betzora, which are of course very much connected to the theme of Tzaras in its various forms. And I'd like to actually focus our attention more on the parsha of Metzora. The way the parshas are apportioned, we tend to see Metzora less. And Metzora begins with the purification of the Metzora. And as we know, there's a certain process that he needs to go through even before he brings his korbanos. So it's not that as soon as the tzaras begins to clear up, he brings korbanos and he's back in circulation. Rather, there is a corridor beforehand where there's a specific process of tahara, of purification, which lasts for 8 days, and then he brings his korbanos. And that is described in detail by the opening psukim of Parshas Metzora. That's Vayikra Perek Yud Dalet. And there are a number of very distinct features in this tahara, which are quite well known to us. Foremost amongst them are the two birds, the Shtei Tziporim. And if we see the pasuk itself, Perek Yud Dalet, pasuk Dalet, Vitziva HaKohen, the Metzora, he's coming in from the cold, and the Kohen commands, V'lokach la'mitaher, and they shall take for the one who is being purified, Shtei Tziporim Chayos Tahorus. The first thing they take are these two birds. Okay, why birds? Rashi comments, even though on a pshat level, a bird means a bird, but Rashi feels that even within the context of explaining the pshat, some explanation of the symbolism and the meaning behind these various components of the tahara is in place. And therefore Rashi says, Lefisha negoim boim aloshen hara. Rashi takes what is the prevalent cause for negoim, for the afflictions of tzaras. It is not the only cause. The Gemara lists seven and the Medrash lists others, but it is the primary cause, and it comes from Lashon Hara. Shehu ma'aseh pitputei dvarim, which is chirping, effectively. Twittering. And leficha chuzku letaroso, so in order to effect his purification, so you bring tziparim shemepatpetim tamid. He brings birds that chirp the whole time, as if to say, that's you. We've mentioned in the past the messages that come, the Musar messages that come to the Metzora, they're not given to him when he's in quarantine. We wait for him to come back because he needs a bit of time just to recognize that there's a problem before we even talk about what the problem is. And therefore his time away, that's for his system to be shaken up a little bit. There is no way that he can avoid beyond that point realizing I do have a problem. Once that's true, a conversation can take place. And it starts by us saying, take a look at these birds, and that's basically you, and maybe you should rethink things. It's interesting that we bring two birds. And it's also interesting that not the same thing happens to the two birds. One of them is slaughtered, is shechted, and its blood is brought into a bowl. The other is, together with a few other things that we'll get to quite soon, is dipped in the blood of the shechted one and then sent away. What is behind this? What does all of this mean? And a very interesting follow-on discussion takes place in a sefer called Apurion. The sefer Apurion was written by Reb Shlomo Ganzfried, who is famous as the author of the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, but he also has a sefer on the Torah. It's called Apurion. He is Shlomo, Apurion Osel Shlomo. It's not in print. I don't know why. It should be. It's a classic. But he explains as follows. When a person becomes appraised of the negative possibilities of Lashon Hara, which are many and manifest, there is a danger that he may come to the conclusion that the moral of the story is just don't say anything. Speech equals evil. And when people speak, they speak Lashon Hara. So the antidote to Lashon Hara is silence. The opposite of Lashon Hara is silence. But that's not true. Lashon Hara is a corruption of speech. But the opposite of Lashon Hara isn't silence. It's Lashon Tov. The opposite of negative speech is positive speech. You just need to be fully, fully aware of the dangers of negative speech. But when you are, so on the contrary, your goal in life should not be to say nothing to anyone. Your goal in life is to say the right things wherever you can. And that is why, says Rav Shlomo Ganzfried, two birds are brought. And one of them is shechted. And the shechted bird represents the deadly potential for negative speech. It could really cause terrible destruction. And the person needs to know that. But there's another bird. And the second bird isn't shechted. The second bird is sent away. It's sent free. Because if you are fully aware of the dangers of negative speech, so then now you're free. You can speak freely in a positive way. And it's quite a traumatic thing. Maybe not for the bird, we don't know, certainly for us. For the bird that's sent away to be dipped into the blood of the bird that was shechted is basically making it aware in no uncertain terms of just how much death can be brought about by Lashon Hara and associated speech. So that's quite an intense thing. But once it happens, so then the bird is free to go. And so is the person. And we look forward to hearing good things from them. And this really underscores an idea that we've mentioned in the past from the Sephorno. One of the korbanos, when he comes to bring korbanos, one of the korbanos that is brought by the Metzora is a korban asham. Those familiar with from Ezu Mekomam, the various ashamos, asham kezelos, asham ilos, asham Metzora. It's a guilt offering, and he is guilty. He's guilty of Lashon Hara. But the Sephorno says that this asham, this guilt offering, is actually a sub-branch of a prior asham, of a different guilt offering. And that is asham me'ilos. If a person, what is me'ila? Me'ila is to use something that's sacred and consecrated, to use it for a mundane purpose or even a negative purpose. That's me'ila. As we know, there's a Masechta the Mishnah is called me'ila. Says the Sephorno, if a person uses his mouth for Lashon Hara, it's not just, quote-unquote, that he's done an Avera. It's Me'ila. He has a holy faculty of speech. He can do holy things with it. He can learn Torah. He can pray. He can bring shalom between people. He can create positivity in his surroundings. All of these are holy things. And that very same faculty, he's abused it by using it for negative purposes. That's Me'ila. And a person does Me'ila is obligated to bring an Asham. And that's really underscoring what the Apirion is saying, that the ideal recovery from Lashon Hara is that a person is now free to use his speech, what it should be used for, to elevate himself, to elevate people around him, and to promote only goodness and holiness. That's the message from the two different trajectories of the two birds in the original Tahara. Classic insight from Rav Shlomo Ganzfried. Alongside the two birds are other elements also, and they should not go unnoticed by us. If we read the pasuk again, Perek Yudalad, pasuk Dalad. V'tzivo ha-kohen v'lokach la-mitaher, shtei tziporim chayos tahoros, the two birds that we spoke about a little bit. And what else? The eitz erez, the piece of cedar wood, ushni tola'as, and scarlet thread, ve'ezov, and hyssop. These actually will occur elsewhere also in the Parah Aduma, but in our context, that's the package. The two birds plus these other materials, the cedar wood, the scarlet thread, and the hyssop. What is the message of the scarlet thread and the hyssop? And the cedar wood, especially even before we consult any commentators, we note ourselves. These are very different materials. Cedar wood is a very high thing. A cedar tree is a lofty tree. The other things are very low. A worm is a low thing. The thread that comes, the shnito la'as. And so is a hyssop. It's a lowly shrub. So where are we? Are we up or are we down? Are we emphasizing something that's tall or something that is low? And here too, Rashi comments and says, Eitz Erez. Lefisha negoim boim al gaso saruach. Rashi notes another cause for negoim, for sara'as afflictions, gaso saruach, haughtiness. So you bring a cedar tree, but you also bring shnito las ve'ezov, these low things. Why? Says Rashi, matakonoso, what's the antidote? V'yisrape, that he should be healed. Yashpil atzmo mika avoso. Let him lower himself from his haughtiness. Ketolas uke ezov. Like the worm, and like the lowly hyssop bush. So according to Rashi, these three materials, interestingly, are problem and antidote. It's a composite presentation. You have on the one hand the errors, which is the problem. But then you have the solution. So there's something of a continuum here. That is the explanation according to Rashi. But based on other Meforshim, Rishonim even, perhaps there is another way to look at the high cedar tree and the low worm and see what it is that they are saying to the Metzora. When we ask the million-dollar question, what is it that brings people to speak Lashon Hara? The answer that is normally given is that it's gaiva, it's egocentricity, that they feel they're better than other people and therefore they point out everyone else's faults. And that is the standard understanding. But there's room to ponder this a little more, for the basic reason that if a person believes that they are better than other people, if they really believe it, then you will not find them highlighting the shortcomings of other people because it's not necessary. Moshel, lemahadava domer. If a person is wealthy, so then they are. They don't spend their day highlighting how poor other people are. It's not relevant to them, and it's not necessary for them. Which leads us to a bit of a deeper level here within the Lashon Hara speaker. And that is that if he does highlight the faults of others, even though he feels that he's better than them, part of him knows that that's not true. In other words, a person likes to feel superior, but often it's based purely on the fact that they're them. I mean, there isn't really much objective merit there, but it's a natural feeling that a person feels better than others. But it's not based on anything. But they'd still like to feel that way. But there's an element within the person that realizes that that's not true. I mean, that's not real. It's not necessarily false, but that's not a basis. And that is why you have now a very complicated situation where a person likes to feel a certain way. They know that it's not necessarily true. So how do you deal with that? To prove that it is true. But who are you proving it to? To yourself. But that means that you know that it's not true. If you know something isn't true, why would you want to prove that it is true? Because you'd like it to be true. And this now becomes the difficult internal dynamic of a person having now to create a narrative of perfection or of superiority. But it needs to be fueled. Because part of them doesn't buy it. And therefore they need to convince themselves. And what is the fuel for that narrative? It's the ongoing highlighting of other people's faults. As if to say, you see, it is true what I'm saying. And this is a person effectively talking to themselves. But to the element that isn't convinced, the other element needs to do the convincing, and the people that are enlisted in order for that to happen are all those around. And this is a very difficult situation, because effectively, the person knows that it's not true, wants it to be true, and it's all rolled together. And that's a Lashon Hara speaker. And there's a very interesting and well-known comment of the Chovos HaVavos, who states, it's in Shar HaKniya, that in the future, when a person is called to account for their wrongdoings, it's possible that a person may be presented with averos that they never did. And when they protest their innocence with regards to those averos, they will be told, true, you never did these averos, but people that you spoke Lashon Hara about, they did them. And because you spoke Lashon Hara about them, you are now accountable for some of their averos as well. It's a very interesting concept. The Chovos HaVavos is not the only Rishon to say this. The Sefer Hasidim likewise says this. That somehow, by speaking Lashon Hara about someone, part of the price you pay is that some of their averos are transferred to you. It is for this reason, and this is very near the beginning of the Sefer Shmiras HaLashon, which is the Chofetz Chaim's, in addition to the Halachos of Shmiras HaLashon, which is the Sefer Chofetz Chaim, but there are also the ethical and Musar ideas that accompany Shmiras HaLashon that promote it and develop it, called Shmiras HaLashon. And right in the beginning, the Chofetz Chaim says, you know, the famous pasuk in Tehillim about a person guarding their speech, Netzor Lashon Chameira, who is the person that desires life? So the first thing you're told is, Netzor Lashon Chameira. Protect your tongue from bad. Then it says, Sur Meira Va'asei Tov. Avoid bad and do good. That would seem to cover everything. Lashon Hara is also bad. Why not just put the whole thing together in one pasuk? Avoid everything bad and do everything good. Why does Lashon Hara get its own independent mention? And even before we talk about avoiding bad and doing good generally, and the Chofetz Chaim gives a number of explanations, but one of them is based on this idea of the Chovos HaVavos. Because if a person is not careful about the people that they speak about and the things that they say about them, from a certain point of view, it might not help them that much to avoid bad and do good, because they might still end up having to answer for averus that they didn't do because they weren't careful about how they spoke. So if you want your avoidance of evil and you're engaging in good things to pay off for you, be sure to keep them and not to receive from anyone else. But that means, firstly, you need to be careful not to avoid Lashon Hara, so that the only wrongdoings that you'll need to answer for are your own. Then it will be a good venture for you to set about Sur Meira Va'asei Tov. So says the Chofetz Chaim. But to come back to the idea itself, the Chovos HaVavos, again, to restate it, it's such a striking idea that if a person speaks Lashon Hara about others, he can receive the punishment for some of their averos. He doesn't say how much Lashon Hara you need to speak or what the rate of exchange is. He doesn't get involved in details. But the principle itself needs to be explained. Last we heard, a person is responsible for their own wrongdoings. Lashon Hara is another wrongdoing. Okay, and maybe he needs to answer for that. But since when does he then start to need to answer for someone else's averos that they never did, just quote unquote, because he spoke Lashon Hara about them? I mean, where is that coming from? And the Rav of the one of the great Rabbanim of Beit Vegan, Rav Freund, Rav Zev Freund, Shlita, gives a fascinating explanation. A person needs to be accountable for an avera either that they did or that they have a part of, that they have a share in. Says Rav Freund, if you speak Lashon Hara about someone, so you have a share in their averus. Why? Because what is the reason the person speaks Lashon Hara? In order to establish and assert and verify their status as a tzaddik. In other words, from your perspective, if you're a tzaddik, your basis for seeing yourself as a tzaddik are the averus of someone else. So your position of tzidkus, your righteous status is you need someone else's averus in order to get you there. So then you have a chelek in their averus. You're a partner with them because you reap the dividends. If they're a Russia, now you can be a tzaddik. So you have a share in their averus. So that you need to answer for some of them. This is the full expression of the dysfunctional nature of the person who speaks Lashon Hara. There is, I'm not sure if these terms are still used anymore, but there is a condition of well-being. It's called being okay. It was, in its time, a very popular term. It's a very simple term, but what it means is that a person has basically a positive self-image. For a person to be okay. And it's very important that a person should be okay. Chas v'chalila, a person should never have a negative self-image. What good will come from that? It's good for a person to be okay, but it's also good for others to be okay as well. Then he's fully okay. I'm okay, you're okay. That's how it goes. But when it comes to a person who speaks Lashon Hara, it is an abuse of that concept. Because the Baal Lashon Hara says, I'm okay, specifically because other people aren't okay. That's what makes me okay. They need to be not okay for me to be yes okay. They need to be Rishoyim in order for me to be a tzaddik. So I need them. Okay, so pay for some of their affairs. It's really a very thought-provoking concept, and it comes from this idea. What drives a person to speak Lashon Hara, to continue to feed that narrative to themselves? It's interesting, coming back to the pasuk that we say it on Sukkot Zimra on Shabbos, and we know the pasuk very well, Mi'a Isha Chafetz Chaim, who's the one who desires life? So we're told actually four things. Number one, Nitzor Lashon Chameira. Guard your tongue from evil. Number two, usfasecha midar ber mirma, and your lips from deceit. And then sor meira, avoid bad, v'asetov, and do good. So if we broke it down as much as we can, there's actually four things. We would have more generally said there's two things: care for what you speak and do the right thing. But in that first pasuk, if we take a look at it, I think there's a simple question to be raised. Many people can see that they might have an issue with Lashon Hara. It's not hard to spot if your eyes are open. You say a bad thing about a person, that's Lashon Hara, that's what it is. But in addition to being told, guard your tongue from evil, we're also told, Sfasech midaber mirma, and your lips from deceit. You know, even though Lashon Hara is not a good thing, but most self-respecting Lashon Hara speakers would not feel that they are involved in deceit. I would never deceive someone. I don't mind slandering them, but I'm not a deceitful person. So why is deceit mentioned as an equal concern together with Netzor Lashon Chameira? And on a simple level, it's really to cover all forms of bad speech. But in terms of our discussion, perhaps we may suggest something else. Namely, that every time a person speaks Lashon Hara, they are engaging in deceit. Because what is Lashon Hara if not the perpetuation of a person deceiving themselves? They're looking to convince themselves of something that's not true. That is deceit. So the narrative that I'm a perfect tzaddik, which requires Lashon Hara, so it's fueling a deceit. And that needs to go. Why? Because the next pasuk says, the way to become a good person is to do the right thing. If all your energy is poured into presenting and embellishing the and confirming the narrative that you're a tzaddik, so then you don't do the right thing anymore because I don't need to. If I'm a tzaddik, I'm already doing the right thing. I don't need to develop myself. That's really part of the tragedy of the person who speaks Lashon Hara. Not only is it not true, it actually stops it from becoming true. There is no incentive for a person to try and be good if all of their energy is poured into showing how good they are in the first place. And therefore, says David HaMelech in Tehillim, that deceit has to go. And when it does go, you'll finally be able to become the tzaddik that you'd like to be. Through the good old-fashioned way. Through avoiding the wrong thing and doing the right thing. That's how people actually become tzaddikim. Not just by feasting on the faults of others and being a tzaddik in relief. Or by inference, by contrast. What emerges is quite a startling idea. And that is, where does the cycle, when is it broken? After all, how much Lashon Hara does a person need to speak in order for them to be finally convinced that they are really the tzaddik that they say they are? There is no end to it. The part of them, others around them, or the part of them within themselves that didn't believe it in the first place won't believe it even after an nth degree of Lashon Hara. Nothing's going to make a difference. So it will never end. So how does it end? Where does the breakthrough come from? It comes from a most unusual place. From a person recognizing and accepting the fact that they too have faults. That's what they are doing everything possible to avoid recognizing. No faults, and I'll prove it, because look at the faults of Plony. So when does a person break out of all of that? When they're finally come face to face with the idea that like everyone else, they have their good points and they have their bad points. And work on your good points and work on getting rid of your bad points. It was only when it was forbidden for me to recognize my low points that I had to take the route of Lashon Hara to present the idea that I have only high points. But as soon as I'm able to confront the fact that like everyone else I have low points, okay, so now get to work. And this now is the antidote in the Tahara package of the Metzora, where he's given something that is lofty, cedarwood, and he's given things that are low, the thread from a worm and the hyssop. And unlike Rashi, and it's based on other Rishonim, but unlike Rashi, that those are things of how a person looks at himself. He sees himself at high. He should see himself as low. Here, They're bundled together because they're both true. You are high and you're also low, and that makes you like everyone else. And therefore, now you're free. You're free from having to pretend that you have no low points because you do. So now, if that's true, so then get to work on them. But you no longer need to create some type of other veneer, but using other people's fault in order to promote that. This is perhaps another way to relate to the highs and the lows. Both exist together. They're both true. And when you realize they're both true, you can develop the first, work on the second, and get on with things. And the compulsion for Lashon Hara hopefully will be pushed by the wayside. All of this is turning to the person and saying that nothing will really change unless you change your perspective. Nothing will really change unless you confront certain things. No one can help you until you help yourself. It's a very interesting comment of the Sefer Medrash Shmuel. Medrash Shmuel, by Rabbi Shmuel de Uzida, a Talmud of the Arizal, is a Perush on Pirkei Avos. But in his introduction to the Sefer Medrash Shmuel, he actually quotes the pasuk at the beginning of Parshas Metzora, pasuk Gimel. So Perek Yudalet, pasuk Gimel. V'yatza kohen al michutz l'machane. So once the symptoms have cleared up, so the Metzora starts to come back, the kohen goes out to meet him. V'ra'ah ha'kohen, the kohen sees, v'hinei nirpa nega tzaras min ha'tzaruah. The tzaras affliction has been healed from the Metzora. And there is a basic pshat question. Those final two words, min hatzarua, seem to be completely redundant. Again, the pasuk reads, the Kohen sees, v'ra'ah ha'kohen, v'hinei, nirpa nega hatzaras min hatzarua. the tsaras affliction has been healed from the tsarua. That's where it's been. Where else is it going to be healed from? He's the one that's got it. If it's healed, it's healed from him. What is added by these two words, min hatsarua? Where who else is going to be healed from? He's the only one that had it in this instance. And this question is addressed by the Medrash Shmuel. And he explains that the words min hatsarua, they don't mean from the tsarua in the sense that the illness is clears up from him, meaning he goes from being afflicted to non-afflicted. It's not min hatsarua in that way. It's min hatsarua in the sense that the refuah can only come from him. He is the cause of his refuah, because he will only be healed if he takes the necessary messages to heart. No one can do that for him. It's not like any other sickness. Another sickness, someone else can cure you. A doctor can cure you. But here, no one can cure him. Because if he doesn't change the way that his approach to things, it won't go away. So when will it go away? When he does change. So who is behind his cure? He is. And that's why it says, when Saras clears up, you know who is behind it? You know where this came from? You know where the cure came from? It came min hatsarua. Good for him. He's taken things to heart. He's ready to listen and hear. He's behind all of his problems. He's also behind all of his solutions. No one else is. That's a classic comment of the Medrash Shmuel in his Akdama there on our pasuk. Well, from the Parsha of Metzora, I would like to move now to take a look at the Haftorah of Metzora, the famous situation of the Arba Mitzorayim. Briefly, what happened was you had these Mitzorayim, they're thrown out of the city. The city was besieged by the forces of Aram. They were basically starving, and they made the decision to throw themselves at the mercy of Aram. They might be killed on the spot, but at least there is a pond, because they're going to die here anyway. So there's a chance they'll be fed. When they came to the camp of Aram, they found it was completely empty because Hashem had caused a great commotion and the enemy has fled. That gave them the privilege now of telling the people inside the city that the city was no longer besieged. So there's many, many aspects to this story. But there is a classic discussion, and it begins by raising the question, who are these Arba'a Mitzorayim? Do we know? It happens to be that we do. There are four famous Mitzorayim of that time. They are none other than Gehazi and his three sons. How do they come to be Mitzorayim? So this actually dates back to an earlier story, which is the Haftorah for Parshas Tazria, which is almost never read, because either the Parshas are together, or it's one of the Arba Parshas, etc. I think last year Tazria was read. It's very rare for that Haftorah to be read, but it's the story of Naaman, and Naaman had Saras. He's looking for a cure, and he's sent to Elisha, and Elisha cures him. He tells him by dipping in the Yarden. There is, I saw this morning, a fascinating comment of the Megala Amukos. Megala Amukos, Rabbi Nosson Shapira, one of the great Rabbonim of the 1600s. And Naaman has this problem, and he comes to Elisha, and Elisha says the solution is in the Yarden. How does Elisha know? Well, on a straightforward level, because he's Elisha, so he knows. But is there any way that we can know how he knows, or some type of indication as to how that would be the problem? We know that when a person has they have their name, there's a pasuk that's associated with their name. It starts and ends with the same letters as their name. So if their name is Moshe, so then their pasuk will start with a mem and end with a hey, just like their name does. Naaman starts with a nun and ends with a nun. And there are three psukim in the Chumash that start with a nun and end with a nun. One of them is in the beginning of Tazria. Nega tzaras ki tiye ba'adam. If you have a nega nun, starts nega tzaras, he's brought to the Kohen, ends with a nun. That's the first pasuk. The starts and ends with nun about tzaras. Next, The pasuk in Shoftim says, "Navi mi'achecha mikirbecha mi'achecha kamocha, yakim lecha Hashem elokecha, eilav tishma'un." I will appoint a navi over you. Listen to him. It starts with the nun of navi, ends with the nun of tishma'un. And the final pasuk that starts and ends with nun in the Chumash is about the Yarden. When the two tribes of Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven come to Moshe, they say, "Nachnu na'avor chalutzim, ad asher na'avor es hayarden." So these are the three psukim. They're all na'aman psukim. They all, like him, they start and end with nun. And what are the components? Tzara'as, a prophet, and the Yarden. And that, says the Megaleh Amukos, is the remez in the Torah. If you have na'aman and you have tzara'as, The answer lies in the Yarden, which indeed it does. Very interesting transmission of Derech HaRemez from the Megala Amukos. So Naaman is cured. He offers gifts to Elisha, but Elisha refuses. It's a Kiddush Hashem and so on. But Gehazi hears this and runs after Naaman and says, "My master changed his mind, and actually he would like some gifts," which was a terrible waste aside from everything else. And he took some gifts. When he came back, Elisha says, "I know where you've been, and I know what happened, and I know what you did. It was a terrible thing that you did, and your punishment will be that you will now get the Naaman's tzara'as by you and your descendants." And those were Gehazi and his three sons. They're the ones that are outside the city. Now, of the many, many issues and discussions that relate to the Haftorah, one of them is mentioned in the writings of Rabbi Akiva Eger. And it is based on the following. The Mishnah, we may know that the idea that the Metzorah, part of what happens to him is that he's sent out of town. He's sent out of the city. But a Metzorah is not sent out of every city. It's specifically a walled city. So says the Mishnah in Maseches Kelim. In the first parak of Kelim, it's about all the special areas within Eretz Yisrael, moving progressively closer to the Beis HaMikdash itself. And one of them are the walled cities. Says the Mishnah in Maseches Kelim, a Metzorah is sent out from a walled city. What type of a walled city? So here the Bar Tanura and others explain and qualify that, as we know, in order for something to have the kedusha of a walled city, it needs to be walled from the time of Yeshua ben Nun. We're familiar with this from the halachas of Megillah reading, but it's true for other things also, Bati Arichoma, which is coming up in Parshas Bahar. And the same is true for the type of walled city that a Metzorah is sent out of, specifically walled from the time of Yeshua ben Nun. What city are we dealing with in our Haftorah? We are dealing with the city of Shomron in the north of Israel. Shomron? Okay. Apparently, we are to understand that Shomron, putting this all together, they were sent out of the city. So Shomron is a city that's walled from the time of Yeshua ben Nun. The problem is, and this was a question that Rabbi Kiva Eger says was raised to him by a Talmud Chacham, is that the Pasuk seems to indicate otherwise. Because the Pasuk tells us of the inception of the building of the city of Shomron in northern Israel. It was done by one of Malchei Yisrael, the kings of northern Israel, Omri. And in Malachim Aleph, Perek Tet Zayin, Pasuk Kaf Dalet, it says, "Vayiken es Hahar Shomron." He, Omri, this king, he brought the mountain of Shomron, Me'ez Shemer, from its owner, who is called Shemer. That's why it's called Shomron, after the original owner called Shemer. Biki Kraim Kosef, he bought it for a certain amount of silver. Vayiven Esahar, and he built up the mountain. He built it up into a city. Vayikor Eshem Ha'ir, Asher Bana, and he named the city that he built, Al Shem Shemer, named it after Shemer, Adunei Ha'har, Shomron, the owner of the original mountain of Shomron. So here is a pasuk in Sefer Melachim, a good while after the time of Yeshua ben Nun, which seems to be describing a mountain that was brought and then built into a city. That city is called Shomron. But that means that even if it's walled, it's not walled. from the time of Yoshua ben Nun. Why then were these four Mitzrayim thrown out of the city? It wasn't necessary. It's not Mukav Choma from Yoshua ben Nun. That's the Shaila. And Rabbi Kiva Eger responds by saying that it could be that this is why the Targum, and the Targum on Nevi'im is Yonas and Ben Uzziel, so says the Gemara Megillah and Daf Gimel. The Targum Yonas and Ben Uzziel, if you look carefully, you'll see something very interesting. Because, again, the Pasuk says that Omri purchased a mountain, then it says he built up the mountain, and then he gave a name to the city. And he gave a name to the city after the owner of the original mountain. So the word mountain actually is mentioned three times. He bought the mountain, he built up the mountain, and named it after the original owner of the mountain. If you look in the Targum Yonason, says Rabbi Kiva Eger, you will see that that his translation of the first two references to a mountain is Kracha, which is a city. It's only the third mention of mountain, Shemer, the owner of the mountain, that he translates into Aramaic as Tura, which is a mountain. But if the word mountain is mentioned three times in the Pasuk, why would the Targum Yonason only translate it as mountain the third time and translate it rather as city the first two times? It appears that what the Targum Yonason is indicating to us is that there was originally a city there on the mountain. When he purchased it, there was a city, and he purchased the mountain together with the city. And when he says he built up the mountain, it means he built up the city. He fortified it and whatever else he did. But there was already a city there, and that's why the Targum, on the first two references to mountain, translates it as city. And if there was already a city there, it could be that city was walled from the time of Yeshua ben Nun, but it wasn't built from scratch. That's what we seem to see from the Targum Yonason. This was the response of Rabbi Kiva Eger there, in his Tosus Rabbi Kiva Eger to Maseches Kelim. Well, there is another response, another approach to this question, and it's found in the Meshech Chochma. And interestingly, the Meshech Chochma, he gets straight down to his explanation. He doesn't mention any difficulties, any issues, any questions that were raised, but it's clear that he is addressing this matter. And again, to review our question, we understand that a Mitzorah would only be thrown out, the Halacha would only require a Mitzorah to be thrown out from a city that was walled from the time of Yeshua ben Nun. Here, these four Mitzrayim were thrown out from the city of Shomron. The simple reading of the Pasuk indicates that Shomron was built by the king Omri, and therefore it was built after the time of Yeshua ben Nun. Why would they need to be thrown out? It seems unnecessary, halachically, says Meshech Chochma, and this very same explanation is also given by Rabbi Yaakov Etlinger, the author of the Aruch Laner, in his Tshuvas Binyan Sion. Says Meshech Chochma, it's true. It wasn't necessary halachically, but they did it anyway, non-halachically. But with what in mind? Says Meshech Chochma, the kingdom in the north of Israel, what's called Malchus Yisrael, had seceded from the kingdom in the south. The kingdom in the south is where the Beis HaMikdash is. The kingdom in the south, what's called Malchus Yehuda, is where Yerushalayim is. And that's why Yeravam, who was the one who originally seceded and created this northern kingdom, he actually had to actively discourage people from doing Aliyah L'Regel, because he doesn't want them going down south. So he created his own places of worship, his own egels. But how far did this go? Yerushalayim is the capital of Israel. But we're not part of that country anymore. We're not part of that kingdom. So then, but what about the capital? We have a new capital. It's called Shomron. Shomron was set up to be the northern equivalent of Yerushalayim with zero halachic basis. But they could not really feel that they were a full kingdom if the real capital is in the south? So what's the solution? Get our own real capital. Shomron. And there you go. And this actually is voiced in Chazal. There is a Medrash, it's a Tana Devei Eliyahu, and the Medrash says, Amru, they said, the people of the northern kingdom of Israel said, Keshem she Yerushalayim lemalchei Yehuda, just like there's Jerusalem for the kings of Yehuda, Kach Shomron lemalchei Yisrael, so too there is Shomron for the kings of Israel. You have your capital, we have our capital, and yours isn't better than ours. But there is no such thing as Shomron is not a capital of anything. But they had to create it as such. They had to fabricate it as such. And in order to establish its status, its bona fide status as a capital, they gave it all the halachas of Yerushalayim. Now, okay, a Metzora would be thrown out of Yerushalayim. Well, if the southern kingdom is going to throw their Metzorahim out of their capital, so we have to do the noble thing. And that is to throw our Mitzvah out of our capital. Just to display just how real a capital it is. And none of it was real. The Kedusha of Shomron was fabricated as a capital city to give equivalent Kedusha to Yerushalayim. And what's further interesting is, says Meshech Chochma, the Pasuk says that these four Mitzvahim, they were by the gate. What's the significance of them being by the gate of the city of Shomron? The gate of the city, is that part of the city? So it happens to be, the Gemara says, that the gates of Yerushalayim were never sanctified to the same degree as the rest of the city in order to afford refuge for Mitzrayim who are thrown out of the city. At least they can place themselves under the gate. So once again, says the kingdom of Yisrael, okay, so our Shomron is the northern equivalent of Yerushalayim. Are Mitzrayim thrown out? Of course. Just like they're thrown out of Yerushalayim, they're thrown out here. Can they congregate by the gate? Absolutely. Just like Yerushalayim. So it was down to a T. The whole thing was a fiction, but it was a perfect fiction. Including the exception of the gates. Why would we be Machmer in the gates? Jerusalem's not Machmer in the gates. And that's how these four Mitzrayim, they were the victims of a production of a capital that had them thrown out. And that's how they found themselves outside. So says Meshech Chochma and the Aruch Lanier. Quite different than Rabbi Akiva Eiger. And there is a third approach still to this question as to why these four Mitzrayim were thrown out of the city. And it's found in the Perush Avas Yehonason of Rabbi Yonason Eibeshitz. Each of these are so different, distinct in their approach. And he begins by saying as follows. You know, it's interesting that we say the Metzora is thrown out of town. Why? For what purpose? We would naturally assume it's for quarantine purposes. In other words, he shouldn't be in town. People could catch tzaras from him, and therefore he's thrown out of town. But that's not the case for a couple of reasons. Firstly, if that was the case, why should there be a difference between a walled city and a non-walled city? If he's a danger to people in town, throw him out of town regardless. And secondly, Rabbi Yonason Eibeshitz is of the understanding that the tzaras that the Torah speaks about is not a contagious disease. It isn't caught from someone else. It sprouts because a person is dysfunctional, because a person speaks Lashon Hara. That's where it comes from. Which means there isn't really a problem for the contagion-wise for the Metzora to stay in town. You don't have to worry about catching tzaras from him. That type of tzaras is not contagious. The only way that you're going to catch tzaras from him is if you catch Lashon Hara from him and start speaking it yourself. So that's why, not from every town, not from every city, is a Metzora sent forth. It's got to be a walled city. It's not about quarantine issues. It's not about contagion. It's about the conditions that require him to be sent out. But that's all true for the tzaras that the Torah speaks about as a punishment for Lashon Hara, as described in Parshas Tazria and Metzora. There is also a condition which could be called saras, which is called saras, and it's closer to what we call leprosy, and it's contagious, and that's a separate thing. It's similar. And if a person had that, you'd throw them out of town regardless of whether it was walled or not. So no one should catch it. Or put them wherever they are, where they need to be, in their colonies or wherever. Somewhere else. Even if it's not walled. Because this isn't about fulfilling the halacha of sending them a tzara for. This is about protecting the people from catching a contagious disease. Because there is a form of tzaras which is a contagious disease. It's just not the one the Torah is talking about. But when we come to the Haftorah of Tazria and we find Naaman, and Naaman has tzaras, well, what type of tzaras do we assume Naaman had? I don't think Naaman got tzaras living in Assyria, a non-Jewish Assyrian general, because he spoke Lashon Hara. That's probably the least of his worries. If Naaman has tzaras, it's the medical condition. It's a contagious disease. And he's looking to get rid of it. And he did. He was cured. He came to Elisha. Elisha cured him. But then Gehazi made a mistake, acted incorrectly, and asked for a gift on Elisha's behalf. And what is Elisha's response? The punishment for what Gehazi did is to say, "V'tzara'as Naaman tidbak b'cha uv'zaracha." Naaman's tzara'as will now adhere to you and your descendants. That means that when Gehazi and his descendants were punished with tzaras, it was also not the tzaras of Tarpasha Tazri and Metzora. It was the tzaras of Naaman. As surely as Naaman is a contagious medical condition, that's what Gehazi had. And now, says Rabbi Yonah Sadai Bishitz, if you're wondering why he was sent out of the city, even if it wasn't walled from the time of Yeshua ben Nun, that's got nothing to do with it. Walled versus not walled is if you're talking about the halachic condition of tzaras, where you're sent out for other reasons, not for contagious reasons. But if you have the tzaras of Naaman, they're going to send you out regardless. And that's why they were sent out. And interestingly, this idea is echoed by Rav Reuven Margolius in his Perush Margolius Hayam on Maseches Sanhedrin, Daf Kuf Zayin, and he says it can actually be demonstrated from another halacha. The halacha states that when a metzora is sent out of town, he needs to sit badad yeshev, alone. And the halacha stipulates he needs to be alone, meaning he cannot even be together with other metzoraim. Which again makes perfect sense, because if it's about a medical condition, they've all got it. What difference does it make? But this is about his punishment. He can't even be together. But all of these four Mitzrayim were together. Why? Because they have the tzaras of Naaman. It's a condition. They're not going to make things worse by keeping each other company. At least they can keep each other company. And that's why they were together. If it was a halachically mandated being sent forth in the city, they couldn't even be together. Each one would have to find a different gate or something like that. So these are the three classic responses to this question with regards to Shomron. One never really knows what will spark a discussion in the Haftorah. No sooner has it begun with the first pasuk already, all the Meforshim get involved, Rabbi Kiva Eger, Meshe Chochma, Aruch Laner, Bjornson Ibishitz, and others as well. Let us just conclude by referring to a Rashi on Saras of houses, and that is in Perik Yudalid, Pasuk Lamed Dalet. And there's a well-known comment of Rashi. The shaila why Rashi makes that comment is something we'll need to look into another time. But this is the tzaras of houses. Perig Yudalet Pasuk Lamed Dalet. Ki savo'u el eretz Canaan. When you come to the land of Canaan, asher ani nosein lachem la'achuza, that I'm giving you as a holding, v'nosati negat tzaras beveis eretz achuzaschem. And I'm going to put tzaras in the houses, which is interesting because it sounds like it's something that's going to happen, not something that might happen. But Rashi says, "Besorehi lahem." It's good news for them. There's a silver lining here, literally. Why? Because shahnegoyim barim aleihem. It's good for them to know that these afflictions will come. Because the Emorim, they stored and stashed away treasures of gold in their walls. the whole 40 years, they want to protect their money, so they put it in their walls. But of course, something that happens with the nega of a house is that the walls are broken down. But when the walls are broken down, so then you find all of the hidden treasure. It's an amazing Rashi. And Rashi, again, is there to explain to us the pshat and the pasuk. That will need further iyun based on Mefarshei Rashi. Why does Rashi bring this? But it's a well-known comment. And what are we saying? That you have to break the house, but when you break the house, you find treasure. The Sefer Akedas Yitzchak, Rabbi Yitzchak Arama, has a very wonderful comment here. And with this, we'll conclude. Says the Akedas Yitzchak, this idea that when Negoim, when Saras happened, that they lead a person to break through a wall and find treasure, it's true not only for Saras of a house. It's also true for Saras of a person. When Saras comes upon a person, you know what that leads to? It leads to breakage. Certain things need to be broken down. And when you do, you discover treasure. You discover hidden treasure. Hidden where? Within the person. Within the walls of the person. Imagine a person who's speaking Lashon Hara. From their perspective, life is great, but the truth is that they're not doing anything productive. Their life is petty. It's about one-upmanship. It's about fault-finding. It's about promoting falsehood. What type of life is that? Are there any good qualities within them? Yes, but they're not being accessed. They're buried in the walls. And if a person would continue that way, they'll live out a life of smallness. And what's the greatest thing that can happen to them? It's to get Saras. Because what does it do? It forces them to break through those walls. It forces them to confront that the way they're leading their life is not a good way at all. And when they reappraise, and when they take stock, what do they discover? The qualities that have been within them all along, lying, not accessed, untapped. And now a person begins to enlist them and to utilize them and to grow through them. And to lead the type of life for many people, and we know this to be true in so many other contexts, if a person would ever have Saras, if they need it, it's the best thing that ever happened to them. Because what's the alternative? A small life, doing very little, never really using their God-given gifts and talents for any good purpose or for any purpose at all. Along comes Saras, you have to break through the walls. There's a lot of breakage that needs to happen. 100%. But when you do, you find treasures. What are those treasures? What you're really capable of. And then the person re-enters, ready to live life, as the Pasuk says in Tehillim, Mi'a ish ha-chafetz chayim, to really engage in life fully and meaningfully and in the truest sense of the word. These are wonderful ideas for us to ponder and to take to heart. The Mitzvah Hashem, we should always only ever see the positive in others, say the positive about others, and that itself should be a schus for us, leading us towards the Geula. Shaleinu, shekam b'mehera b'yameinu. Amen.